From the sun-scorched hills of colonial Jamaica to the bass-heavy streets of Kingston, from Mento's laughter to dancehall's fire, this is not just music, it's survival, it's rebellion, it's legacy. Journey through 10 powerful chapters that trace how a small island carved out the world's boldest sound. A sound born in struggle, raised in spirit, and remixed by the globe. This is the untold story of how Jamaican music transformed the world, one rhythm at a time. This is the evolution of Jamaican music, Mento to dancehall. Oh, by the way, if you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite platform so you never miss a story. Echoes from the hills, the birth of Mento. They say music was Jamaica's first rebellion, not in words but in rhythm. Before there was a flag, before there was independence, before there was even the idea of a Jamaican sound, there was Mento, raw, rustic, and rooted. You could hear it in the rustling banana leaves, in the clank of machete against sugarcane, and in the laughter that found its way into the night, even when the sky held only hardship. Mento wasn't born in a studio or a concert hall. No, it was birthed in the hills and hollows of the island's heart, where enslaved Africans, indentured laborers, and displaced souls blended their broken pasts into something new. A mix of African polyrhythms, European folk tunes, and Creole storytelling, Mento wasn't just entertainment, it was survival. The lyrics were cheeky, loaded with double meanings, and yet often razor-sharp in their satire, poking at the colonizers, local politicians, and even poverty itself. Long before radio waves carried reggae across oceans, Mento was passed hand to hand, fire to fire, a communal inheritance wrapped in goatskin drums, rumba boxes, banjos, and bamboo fifes. The rum bar became its concert hall, the market its festival stage, the village square its studio, and it told the truths people weren't allowed to say out loud. The 19th century was a time of post-emancipation instability in Jamaica. Freed people were carving out new lives, clinging to old traditions while facing new oppression. British colonizers hadn't left. They had just changed the rules. Amid this, Mento flourished quietly. It was the people's news, comedy, and counseling session all in one. Every beat was a breath taken between injustice and joy. Every lyric, a coded message of defiance. Take a moment to picture it, a humid night in St. Elizabeth or Clarendon. A full moon hangs over a zinc-roofed house. Fireflies flicker like distant spirits watching from the dark. A man with dreadlocked wisdom hums and taps his foot. The rumba box starts thumping. A bamboo sax squeals into the air like it's calling ancestors to dance. And then the Mento begins. Maybe it's a song about a cunning woman tricking a rich white planter. Or a poor man dreaming of breadfruit and better days. The whole village laughs and claps, not just at the humor but at the truth it hides in plain sight. As the 20th century rolled in, Mento was already well established in rural life. Yet it wasn't until the 1940s and 50s that the genre was formally recorded and presented to a broader audience. It happened just as tourism began to creep into the Jamaican economy. The government and business elite, hungry to market Jamaica as a paradise, discovered Mento as a tropical soundtrack, easy, exotic, and non-threatening. Bands like the Jolly Boys, Lord Flea, and Count Lasher began recording Mento tracks not just for locals, but for American and European audiences, giving Mento a momentary commercial glow. But let's be honest, even in its brief spotlight, Mento was never fully understood by outsiders. They heard steel drums and thought of vacations. They heard the laughter but missed the scars beneath it. Mento was always more than sunshine and beaches. It was about survival through satire. It was about coded resistance. It was about cultural preservation. There's a reason why the Mento tradition has remained alive in certain rural parts of Jamaica long after reggae and dancehall dominated the airwaves. It carries an oral archive, a sense of memory that resists erasure. Mento is the grandfather of Jamaican music, but like many elders, its wisdom was often overlooked by the younger generation who were racing toward modernity. Still, it whispered behind every beat, teaching, warning, remembering. Let's not forget that some of reggae's greatest artists were Mento children. Bob Marley's earliest musical influences included rural folk songs and Mento choruses. The syncopation, the patois storytelling, the emphasis on everyday struggle, all of it echoes through the reggae and dancehall scenes that came later. Without Mento, there would be no ska, no reggae, no dancehall. Even today, if you strip down a dancehall rhythm, you'll hear the skeletal rhythm patterns that Mento first offered. Listen closely to a dub track and you may recognize the same structure, reimagined with electronics and space. This is why we say Mento never died, It evolved, disguised in every new Jamaican beat. So why does Mento matter now? Because in a world obsessed with speed and fame, Mento reminds us of the power of slowness, of reflection, of grassroots creation. It teaches that music doesn't need a million-dollar studio or a viral video to matter. All it needs is truth and a rhythm honest enough to carry it. Mento is the beginning of the island's musical defiance. It is the voice of cane cutters, market vendors, roadside prophets, and barefoot dancers. It doesn't apologize. It doesn't beg to be remembered. But it deserves to be. Because every beat that ever blasted from a Jamaican sound system, every reggae anthem, every dancehall clash, owes a quiet debt to that laughing, limping, brilliant old sound called Mento. And as we close this first chapter, remember, when the next beat drops in this story, when the tempo rises and ska storms the streets, Mento will still be there in the background, smiling, watching, and guiding the rhythm forward. Skank in the streets, the rise of ska. If Mento was the voice of survival in the hills, then ska was the sound of urban ignition. It emerged not just as music, but as a movement with a pulse, bursting out of Jamaica's growing towns with the energy of a new nation trying to define itself. And when it hit, it didn't whisper, it skanked. The year was 1962. Jamaica had just cut its colonial umbilical cord, declaring independence from Britain. The Union Jack was lowered, and the black, green, and gold flag rose to meet the Caribbean sun. In the capital of Kingston, the streets were alive with hope, chaos, and reinvention. But behind the political ceremonies and headlines, something more powerful was building. A new rhythm. That rhythm was ska, a fusion of Mento's offbeat timing, American R&B swing, and jazz's improvisational edge. It was fast, it was brass-heavy, and it was unmistakably Jamaican. The guitar hit on the upstroke, the signature skank, while walking basslines carried dancers across cracked sidewalks and smoke-filled dance halls. Trumpets blared like fanfares for the island's working class. Drums snapped with urgency. And the people moved, not like they were escaping something but like they were claiming something. This was not music for the elite. Ska was born in the sound system culture, the open-air block parties powered by homemade speakers, neighborhood DJs, and rum-fueled energy. These sound systems were the island's true radio stations, broadcasting not only music but news, gossip, resistance, and style. The biggest of them, Sir Coxone Dodd's Downbeat, Duke Reed's Trojan, and Prince Buster's Voice of the People, became battlegrounds for sonic supremacy. And it wasn't just about the sound, it was about identity. Jamaica in the 1960s was grappling with itself. Freed politically, yes, but still chained economically. The British had left, but their fingerprints remained on everything. The legal system, education, land ownership. The poor and the disenfranchised, especially in ghettos like Trenchtown and Denham Town, needed more than a flag. They needed expression, and ska became their microphone. One man who shaped this movement was the legendary Prince Buster. A former boxer turned producer and sound system innovator, Buster wasn't just making records, he was making statements. His song Hard Man Fay Dead wasn't just catchy, it was culturally coded. It mocked the British belief that they could keep Jamaica down. And in Judge Dredd, he turned the courtroom into theater, where ghetto boys laughed at their oppression. Ska wasn't always angry, but it was always awake. Then there was the Skatalites, a supergroup of classically trained musicians who weaponized ska into a global art form. Their horn sections roared like hurricanes. Their instrumentals, like Guns of Navarone and Eastern Standard Time, fused elegance with edge. They brought ska from dance halls to concert halls, and ultimately to the world stage. But make no mistake, ska was still street music. It played from battered jukeboxes and corner shops, spilled from taxis and powered backyard barbecues. Young people adopted ska not just as a sound but as a lifestyle. You could see it in their style, tight pants, trilby hats, checkerboard prints, and a dance that looked like someone dodging bullets to the beat. They called it skanking, and it was equal parts joy and rebellion. What made ska truly revolutionary, though, was its tempo of hope. It was fast. It was forward. It was black joy in motion, insisting that the future was unwritten and the dance floor was sacred ground. But ska, like the era that birthed it, burned fast and bright. By the mid-1960s, the social optimism began to slow. Political tensions deepened. Economic struggles intensified. And as the beat began to slow, something softer, more introspective, more soulful emerged. A new rhythm that would carry deeper sorrow and deeper strength. That rhythm was rocksteady. But before we get there, we must honor what ska left behind. A cultural roar, a statement of sonic sovereignty that declared, Jamaica is not a shadow of Britain. Jamaica is its own sound. its own nation, and ska was the first heartbeat of that identity. So if Minto whispered survival, ska shouted arrival. It was the music of youth, of motion, of transition, a soundtrack for a people stepping boldly into selfhood. Every horn riff and skank beat still echoes today in the rhythms of ska's descendants across the globe, from London's two-tone to California's ska punk, and yes, even in the DNA of modern dancehall. Because once a nation dances itself into being, it never forgets the music that made it move. Rocksteady rhythms and rebel hearts. As the 1960s wore on, Jamaica began to shift. The tempo slowed, not just in music but in mood. The elation of independence faded into the reality of corruption, poverty, and inequality. Hope still lived on the island, but it no longer danced in a frenzy. It began to sway. That sway, that deep, soulful, bass-heavy sway, was the birth of rocksteady. The ska was a sprint, then rocksteady was a confession. Slower, softer, and soaked in emotion, it traded the brass thunder of ska for deep bass lines, tight guitar rhythms, and haunting harmonies that carried the weight of survival. It emerged around 1966, just as Kingston simmered with rising unemployment, political violence, and a growing class divide. In that heat, a new sound rose, a sound that spoke not of escape but of endurance. The transition wasn't accidental. The summer of 1966 was one of the hottest on record in Jamaica. Musicians, drenched in sweat under zinc roof studios and suffocating dancehall ceilings, naturally slowed the tempo. The horn sections were trimmed back. Singers began to stretch their vocals, pulling on each note like a cry, a plea, a slow-burning declaration of love, struggle, or resilience. It was in this fertile ground that artists like Alton Ellis, Ken Booth, and Phyllis Dillon stepped forward, not with the flashy energy of ska, but with something deeper. Alton's voice, for example, was velvet and steel all at once. In songs like I'm Still in Love and Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, he turned heartbreak into rebellion. Rocksteady's lyrics were tender but never weak. They captured the complex emotional terrain of post-colonial life, where love, betrayal, and yearning were metaphors for a country looking for something solid to hold onto. Then came the Techniques, the Paragons, and the Heptons, vocal groups who wove doo-wop harmonies with island flavor. Their records became soundtracks for teenage romance and political survival alike. And as rocksteady spread, it began to transform sound system culture too. Where once the crowd skanked, they now rocked side to side, eyes closed, lips whispering the lyrics like prayers. Behind the music, an even deeper cultural shift was taking place. The Rastafari movement was beginning to gain traction, carrying messages of black liberation, African repatriation, and spiritual consciousness. These themes began to seep into the music, subtly at first, but undeniably. Rocksteady wasn't just about love songs, it was about identity songs. The search for belonging. The need for grounding. And one name began to echo louder than most in these transitions. Coxsone Dodd, the Studio One producer and sound system kingpin. His studio became the breeding ground for Jamaica's future musical royalty. He didn't just record songs, he curated a movement. Studio One's catalog during the Rocksteady era is a historical treasure. Each song a timestamp in Jamaica's journey through the fire. At the same time, the youth in the ghettos, especially in areas like Tivoli Gardens, Rema, and Jungle, were becoming more politicized. They saw their futures being gambled away by politicians with sweet tongues and clenched fists. Music became both escape and explanation, a means to soothe pain and scream truth in equal measure. Rocksteady artists didn't need to shout. They let the slow rhythms carry the message deeper. Slower, yes, but no less urgent. And then, just as it had arrived, rocksteady began to morph again. Its lifespan was brief, barely 2 years at the forefront. But in that short window, it birthed the foundations of something revolutionary, reggae. Producers began to experiment more with drum and bass, drawing even more influence from Rastafarian Nyabingi rhythms. The offbeat guitar chop became sharper. The bass dropped lower. The tempo leveled into something steady, like a heartbeat, a rhythm that felt like truth. Reggae was on the horizon. But we must honor rocksteady before we move forward, because it was the emotional bridge between celebration and consciousness. It was the soundtrack of gritty hope, of street corner tenderness, of a people learning to speak softly but carry a deep, soulful power. So when you hear Alton Ellis croon or the Paragons harmonize over a swaying beat, know that what you're hearing is not just romance, it's resistance. It's the sound of a culture pulling itself back from the edge and choosing, even in heartbreak, to love itself anyway. Rocksteady was the calm before the revolutionary storm. And the storm was coming, dressed in dreadlocks, marching to a deeper drum. Roots and Revolution, The Reggae Awakening. When the heartbeat of Rocksteady began to steady itself into something more grounded, more prophetic, that was the moment reggae was born. Not with fireworks or declarations, but with a slow, seismic shift that would echo across generations, oceans, and continents. This was not just the arrival of a new musical genre. This was the awakening of a spiritual force, a cultural reckoning, and a global movement disguised in rhythm. It was the late 1960s and Jamaica was on edge. Independence had delivered more flag waving than food. The youth in the ghettos were restless, their lives fenced in by corrupt politics, foreign economic manipulation, and a growing disconnect from those in power. Yet amidst the struggle, something ancient was stirring. A resurgence of African consciousness, spiritual resistance, and cultural pride. Reggae became the vessel. The music slowed even further than rocksteady, settling into a pulse that mirrored the heartbeat of the oppressed. The guitar chopped the offbeat like a machete slicing through cane. The bassline was king, hypnotic, heavy, and meditative. The drums rolled like thunderclouds in the distance. The sound was rooted, grounded, unapologetically Jamaican. But it wasn't just the sound that changed, it was the message. Reggae brought the word, and with it came truth. For the first time, lyrics became a sermon for the streets. Singers no longer crooned about broken hearts. They chanted about Babylon, Zion, freedom, Africa, justice, and revolution. And standing at the center of this sonic awakening was a skinny dreadlocked youth from 9 Mile, St. Anne, a man named Robert Nesta Marley. Marley didn't just sing reggae. He breathed it. He embodied it. And through him, reggae became a global sacrament. But before Bob Marley became a household name, reggae was already being weaponized by a generation of truth-tellers. Burning Spear, with chants as ancient as drumbeats in the Congo. Toots and the Maytals, who gave the genre its name and its jubilant soul. Peter Tosh, the militant prophet who declared war on injustice with his guitar and his razor tongue. Dennis Brown, the crown prince who crooned consciousness with elegance. The Abyssinians, whose harmonies sounded like they were carved into scripture. These were not mere entertainers. They were cultural messengers, spiritual couriers, political rebels dressed in red, gold, and green. Meanwhile, behind the boards, producers like Lee Scratch Perry were creating magic in the Black Ark studio, drenching vocals in echo and mysticism, layering sound like ritual smoke. The studio became a temple, and every track was a testament. The power of reggae was not just in its groove, but in its roots. This was Rastafari music. Not church hymns, not gospel, but groundation. The Nyabingi drums of the hills merged with electric bass. Ethiopian prophecy blended with Jamaican patois. The King of Kings, Haile Selassie I, was not a metaphor. He was living theology and reggae was his trumpet. In this era, music and movement were one. Reggae danced with the people, in dance halls, on street corners, in protests, and in prayer circles. Songs like Get Up, Stand Up, Equal Rights, and Marcus Garvey weren't just anthems, they were marching orders. And when Bob Marley sang One Love, he wasn't offering utopia, he was offering unity in struggle. Jamaica, though small, was becoming the epicenter of global cultural resistance. From the dusty lanes of Trenchtown to the ghettos of Soweto, from Brixton to Brooklyn, from Kingston to Kingston, Ontario, reggae was speaking truth in the language of rhythm. And the world listened. But there was a price. With attention came infiltration. Political parties began to use reggae as a tool of manipulation. Secret wars were waged on the streets, and music became both shield and target. Marley's house was riddled with bullets just days before the Smile Jamaica concert. The message was clear, truth is dangerous. Still, the music never stopped. By the late 1970s, reggae had crossed into every continent. Marley played to over 100,000 people in Zimbabwe during the country's independence celebrations, a moment when African revolutionaries sang Jamaican songs as battle cries. That's when reggae became more than music. It became a mirror reflecting Black struggle, African pride, indigenous resistance, and third world unity. In reggae, the Caribbean told the world, "We are small, but we are not silent." So understand this, reggae was not a trend. It was a cultural awakening, a baptism in bass, a confrontation of colonial residue, a call to consciousness. It was Jamaica's gift to the soul of the world. As we close this chapter, the echo of reggae continues. It shaped the next wave, from dub to dancehall, from Afrobeat to hip-hop, from protest marches to peace concerts. Reggae wasn't just roots music, it was resurrection music. And its roots still grow, underground, unseen, unbroken. Dread Inna Babylon, The Politics of Reggae. By the time reggae was pulsing through the streets of Kingston and into the speakers of global revolutionaries, its role had shifted from art to ammunition. The music that once soothed heartbreaks and lifted spirits now thundered as a weapon of truth, prophecy, and rebellion. Chapter 5 is not just about reggae's sound, it's about the war that raged around it. This was no metaphorical Babylon anymore. The term Babylon, lifted from biblical scripture and reborn through Rastafari theology, became the single most powerful symbol in reggae culture. Babylon wasn't just a place, it was a system. Colonialism, capitalism, imperialism, racism, political corruption, and spiritual emptiness. And by the early 1970s, Jamaica had become its own battlefield between dread and Babylon, the people versus the powerful. Reggae didn't just speak truth to power, it screamed it. And Babylon listened. And Babylon reacted. Let's set the scene. The 1970s in Jamaica was a time of deep political fracture. The People's National Party, PNP, led by Michael Manley, took a bold democratic socialist turn, aligning itself with the Cuban Revolution and preaching self-reliance, black empowerment, and economic reform. Across the aisle, the Jamaican Labor Party, JLP, backed by more conservative elites and Western interests, saw this as a threat. The result? Political warfare in the streets, funded in part by external superpowers, the CIA on one side, Cuban intelligence on the other. Meanwhile, ordinary Jamaicans were being caught in the crossfire. In the midst of this chaos stood reggae artists, cultural truth-tellers who couldn't remain neutral even if they tried. Their songs were now political documents, spiritual declarations, and sometimes even death warrants. Take Peter Tosh, for example. He wasn't just militant, he was a lyrical revolutionary. In Equal Rights, he didn't mince words. Everyone is crying out for peace, yes/none is crying out for justice. Tosh openly called for the legalization of marijuana, the dismantling of white supremacy, and the defense of black dignity. He carried a guitar like a rifle and wore his dreadlocks like a crown. Babylon feared him, and for good reason. Then there was Bob Marley, the prophet in exile, the reluctant messiah. He was adored by both PNP and JLP, yet remained fiercely independent. In 1976, just days before he was to headline the Smile Jamaica concert, a free event meant to ease political tensions, gunmen stormed his home. Bullets ripped through his compound. Marley was shot. His wife Rita was shot. His manager was nearly killed. But Bob didn't flee. He got on stage 2 days later, his wound bandaged, his spirit unshaken. He told the crowd, "The people who are trying to make this world worse aren't taking a day off. How can I?" That performance, trembling, defiant, glorious, became one of the most iconic acts of cultural resistance in history. Marley wasn't just performing. He was declaring war against Babylon through rhythm. But reggae's politics weren't just Jamaican. They were global. As apartheid ravaged South Africa, reggae was banned there because its lyrics were too dangerous. Yet bootleg Marley records were passed hand to hand like sacred scripture in Soweto. In Zimbabwe, reggae became the soundtrack of independence. In the UK, it became the voice of the Caribbean diaspora, fueling the rise of Black British consciousness, Notting Hill Carnival resistance, and two-tone ska. Even in the United States, where black music had largely become commercialized and sanitized, reggae reintroduced the idea of music as movement, sound as protest, and lyrics as liberation. Meanwhile, back home in Jamaica, the divide deepened. Gunmen were aligned with political parties. Ghetto youths were being armed, turned into soldiers for turf wars they didn't start. Sound systems became battlegrounds. Whole communities were split between orange and green, PNP and JLP. And in the middle of it all, reggae kept playing, kept preaching, kept warning. It wasn't just a soundtrack anymore. It was documentation. It was resistance. But Babylon doesn't fall quietly. And in 1981, it landed a brutal blow. Bob Marley died, ravaged by cancer that many still consider suspicious. To the world, it was a tragedy. To Jamaica, it was a moment of collective silence. The lion had roared his last. But even death couldn't stop the movement. If anything, it made the message immortal. Reggae became posthumous prophecy, a genre frozen in its golden era but more relevant with every generation. Tosh would be beaten by police and later assassinated. Many roots artists would fade into obscurity or exile. The dancehall era would soon rise, trading militancy for machismo. But the spirit of reggae, its politics, its roots, its rebellion, never died. Because Babylon still breathes. And reggae is still the mirror held to its face. So when you hear the throb of a bassline or the cry of a Rasta prophet, remember, reggae is not a genre. It is a revolution in disguise. A truth that survived bullets, betrayal, and borders. And it still stands. In dread. In defiance. In the face of Babylon. Dubwise dreams, sonic experiments, and spiritual echoes. If reggae was the cry of the people, then dub was the echo of the divine. It was not just music, it was vibration, space, texture, and alchemy. It didn't shout its message like a political anthem or preach with lyrical clarity. Dub whispered. It pulsed. It haunted. It challenged you to listen not with your ears, but with your spirit. Welcome to the mystical chapter of Jamaican music, where sound bends reality and rhythm becomes ritual. Dub was born in the shadows of reggae, deep in the control rooms of Kingston's dusty studios. In the late 1960s and early 70s, as producers began pressing singles for sound system clashes, they stumbled upon a revelation. Remove the vocals, crank the bass, add a little delay, drop in some reverb, and suddenly, you had something entirely new. Something hypnotic. It started as a technical experiment, a flipside novelty, a version. But under the right hands, visionaries like King Tubby, Lee Scratch Perry, Errol Thompson, and Scientist, dub transformed into a cosmic conversation between silence and sound. Imagine this, a sparse studio lit only by the flicker of analog meters. Smoke curling to the ceiling. Magnetic tape reels spinning like oracles. At the center of it all, King Tubby with hands like a priest over a console. He doesn't play instruments. He plays the mix. Drops the snare into a black hole. Drenches a guitar stab in reverb until it sounds like it's echoing off the walls of creation. Then boom, the bassline returns like thunder behind closed eyes. This is dub. It's not just a remix. It's deconstruction. It's spiritual excavation. Dub took reggae and stripped it to its soul. The spaces between the notes became just as important as the notes themselves. The pauses weren't silent. They were charged with tension, mystery, memory. And for Rastafari musicians and listeners, dub wasn't just studio play, it was a spiritual practice. The deep bass represented the heartbeat of Africa, the ancestral drum. The echo symbolized the voices of the ancestors returning through time. The distortion, the delay, it was Babylon breaking apart sonically. In dub, you hear ritual. Lee Scratch Perry took this to the edge of madness. In his Black Ark studio, he turned dub into a form of Afrofuturism. He used animal noises, broken microphones, rewired machines, and even burned incense inside the studio to alter the spiritual environment. He wasn't just producing tracks. He was summoning energies. Dub in Perry's hands became prophetic. And the global impact? Massive. Dub invented remix culture. Before hip-hop had DJs manipulating records, before EDM had drops and filters, dub was already dismantling and rebuilding music in real time. The idea that a track was never finished, that a mix could be a message, that silence could be sound, all of this came from the dub chambers of Jamaica. In the UK, dub became the backbone of sound system culture in Brixton, Notting Hill, and Birmingham. It blended with punk and birthed post-punk and dubstep. In New York, it laid the foundation for hip-hop's manipulation of breaks and samples. In Berlin, it gave rise to dub techno and experimental electronica. Every drop of bass in today's music owes a debt to dub's sonic rebellion. But even with its influence, dub never craved the spotlight. It remained cloaked, inward, ritualistic. It didn't need a stage. It needed speakers, darkness, and openness. It needed a listener who was ready to descend, into the bassline, into the self. Dub is the meditation between wars, the inhale between chants, the dream behind the revolution. And that's why, even as reggae gave way to the fast, fiery energy of dancehall, dub stayed underground, immortal, uncompromising, eternal. Because while the world moves fast, dub insists on feeling. So when you hear a reverb trail that feels like time unraveling, or a bassline that moves your ribcage more than your feet, you're hearing dub's echo. It's not a genre. It's a portal. And it's still open. Dancehall Genesis, the digital revolution. The rhythm didn't fade, it detonated. When the bassline of dub thundered into silence, it left a vacuum in Jamaica's streets, sound systems, and studios. And what filled that space wasn't quiet reflection. It was raw voltage, digitized defiance, and dance floor fire. It was dancehall, born in the ghettos, shaped by the concrete and electrified by technology. This was the moment when Jamaican music stepped into the future. And it didn't ask permission. The early 1980s were a time of shifting tectonics. Bob Marley had passed. The Cold War still loomed. Global capitalism was steamrolling local economies. Jamaica was reeling from political upheaval, IMF-imposed austerity, and the crumbling of idealism. The reggae prophets had given the message. Now the people needed release. Enter Slang Ting, the rhythm that rewrote the rules. It came from a Casio MT40 keyboard, a preset accidentally discovered by Wayne Smith and producer King Jammy in 1985. The beat was digital, robotic, and infectious. It was like nothing anyone had heard before. Under Me, Slang Ting dropped into the streets like a sonic bomb, and the digital dancehall revolution was born. From that point on, music in Jamaica didn't just evolve, it exploded. Dancehall was fast. Dancehall was raw. Dancehall was Kingston on fire at midnight. The rhythms were built for sound system clashes, where selectors spun tracks like grenades and DJs toasted over beats like preachers at a block party from hell. The dub poet was replaced by the lyrical warrior. The stage was now the street. And the voices that rose from this new sound were unlike anything before. Yellowman emerged first, a towering, albinistic figure whose confidence and charisma made him unstoppable. Despite ridicule and stigma, he turned his differences into dominance. He embodied the defiant joy of early dancehall, ribald, rhythmic, and revolutionary. Then came Josie Wales, Brigadier Jerry, and Charlie Chaplin, each with their own verbal artillery. They didn't sing, they spoke rhythms. Toasting became a kind of street journalism, an oral tradition reinvented. DJs spat about ghetto life, bad mind enemies, rude boys, girls, ganja, and God. There was no censorship. No filter. Just pure expression. This was the language of the streets, finally blasting through speakers. But dancehall wasn't just sound, it was a culture. It was the way people dressed, with bold colors, razor-sharp lines, gold chains, Kangol hats, and Clarks on feet. It was the way they moved, grinding, daggering, signal D-plane, bogle, bruckout. It was parties that lasted till sunrise, speakers stacked like towers and microphones passed like torches. It was the sound of survival and the vibration of joy in spite of suffering. And at the center of it all was the rhythm, repetitive, infectious, universal. Producers like Steely and Cleavey, Bobby Digital, and Jermaine created rhythms that could support dozens of versions, each with a different DJ spitting their truth. If reggae was the singer's arena, dancehall was for the clash, who had the most lyrics, the biggest voice, the wickedest flow. And then came the titans of the 90s. Shabba Ranks, with his bass-heavy growl and international swagger. Buju Banton, who started as a hardcore DJ and evolved into a roots revivalist. Lady Saw, who smashed every gender barrier in sight and stood toe-to-toe with the men, not as a queen but as a general. Bounty Killer and Beanie Man, who clashed with fire but also defined an era. And later, Vibes Cartel, whose lyrical genius and cultural controversy would crown him both king and heretic. Dancehall became the voice of the unheard, those too poor, too rude, too raw for the mainstream. It wasn't clean. It wasn't polished. But it was real. And it was ours. Still, it came with controversy. Dancehall was accused of promoting violence, homophobia, and slackness. International critics condemned it. Jamaican elites tried to silence it. Government raids shut down street dances. But for every stage taken down, two more sprang up. Dancehall wasn't looking for approval. It was looking for a way to breathe. The digital age only made it stronger. Suddenly, rhythms flew across the diaspora. Jamaicans in London, Toronto, Miami, and New York could hear the same beat and add their own voices. Pirate radio, cassette tapes, DVDs, and eventually YouTube, dancehall hacked the system. It became the DNA of reggaeton in Puerto Rico. It shaped Afrobeats in Nigeria and Ghana. It echoed in UK grime, American trap, and even K-pop. Dancehall became the sound of resistance cloaked in rhythm. So what did we lose in the transition? And what did we gain? Some say we lost the roots, the spiritual fire of Rastafari, the moral compass of the elders. Others say dancehall is a new kind of prayer, one shouted rather than sung, one lived through motion rather than meditation. Both are true. Dancehall didn't kill reggae. It rebelled against its rigidity. It took the bassline and said, "Let's go harder." It took the mic and said, "Let me speak." It took the street and said, "This is my truth." So understand this, dancehall isn't reggae's shadow. It is its lightning. Fast, fierce, loud. A genre forged in fire, filtered through zinc rooftops and barefoot dances. This was the beginning of a new Jamaican millennium, and the rhythm still runs. Badman Culture and Bashment Queens. By the time the rhythms were rumbling through every alleyway and across the waters, dancehall wasn't just music anymore. It was a lifestyle, a mirror, and a movement. But inside the bass-heavy clash of digital beats and lyrical fire, something more complex began to unfold. A cultural battleground where masculinity, violence, sexuality, fashion, and gender power dynamics collided. This was the age of the bad man and the bashment queen. It wasn't always about who had the best voice anymore. It was about who had the most respect, the most clout, the most raw truth in their lyrics. Dance hall became the place where street life was not just reflected. It was performed, embodied, and sometimes amplified. Let's start with the badman archetype. This wasn't just a gangster fantasy. In Jamaica's inner cities, where opportunities were scarce and survival was sacred, the badman became a symbol of resistance. He was a rude boy evolved, sharpened by the 1980s political warfare, the 1990s economic collapse, and the rising tides of garrison life. His lyrics told stories of betrayal, loyalty, gunplay, and justice on the streets, often with brutal honesty. Artists like Bounty Killer, Ninja Man, and later Mavado and Idonia carried that torch. Their music spoke to those who had no voice, no wealth, no safety net. It was not about glorifying violence, it was about bearing witness to a society that had turned its back on the ghetto. In songs like Look Into My Eyes, Bounty Killer didn't just spit fire. He cried out, exposing the hypocrisy of governments and the desperation of the poor. But this new era wasn't just ruled by the dons. It was equally built by the bashment queens, women who refused to stay in the background or bow to patriarchy. They came in stilettos, fishnets, and fire. Lady Saw kicked the door down first. Unapologetic. Explicit. Divine and defiant. She was the queen of the dance hall and she didn't ask for space, she took it. Her lyrics were bold, her performances legendary. She challenged the double standards in dance hall. If men could be slack, so could she. If men could brag about sexual dominance, she could flip the script and own her body, her voice, her stage. She redefined female empowerment in Caribbean culture, raw, unfiltered, and brilliantly strategic. Others followed. Spice, who turned bashment into a global brand. Maca Diamond, Susile, Tanya Stevens, each bringing fire and finesse to a genre often hostile to female agency. But the journey for bashment queens wasn't easy. Dancehall has always been a space of contradiction, celebrating femininity while objectifying it, elevating female artists while often boxing them in. Women had to be twice as talented, twice as fearless, and 10 times as unapologetic just to survive the scene. Yet survive they did, and thrive. They brought visibility to body politics, gender injustice, class struggles, and the cultural policing of female sexuality. Whether through lyrics, fashion, or dance, bashment queens declared that there was power in performance, pride in sensuality, and rebellion in rhythm. And then there's the dance culture itself. Dance hall is not complete without the dance. In the early 2000s, the explosion of dance crews, street parties, and YouTube dance videos turned Jamaica into a movement capital. Ding Dong and the Ravers Clavers made moves like Siva, Fling, and Gas go global. Dancers became ambassadors, bringing Kingston steps to Tokyo, Paris, Nairobi, and New York. Dance challenges became currency. The streets were the stage, and every wine bruck out and daggering step was a performance of joy, power, and coded resistance. But as always, dance hall also stirred controversy. Lyrics deemed slack or violent faced bands. Artists were denied visas. LGBTQ+ communities protested homophobic content, sparking international backlash. Jamaican society debated whether dance hall was a cultural treasure or a moral threat. Yet even in the crossfire, dance hall evolved. It became a place of constant tension between spiritual roots and secular freedom, between poverty and aspiration, between male bravado and female defiance, between local struggle and global stardom. And through it all, the badman and the bashment queen stood at the center, not as opposites but as twin forces of defiance, shaping a genre that refused to stay in any one box. Because dance hall at its core is freedom music. Loud, disruptive, unruly. It is Jamaica shouting its truths, even when the world tries to shush them. So next time you see a dancehall queen take the stage in sky-high heels, or hear a DJ roar over a bass-heavy rhythm about pain, power, or pleasure, understand what you're witnessing. It's not just performance. It's a cultural reckoning in real time. The global dancehall effect, reggae's children. Jamaica is only 4,240 square miles. A speck on the map. But its sound, that relentless pulse of mento, ska, rocksteady, reggae, and dancehall, grew too big for borders. By the time the dancehall explosion ignited Kingston street corners, the rest of the world wasn't just listening. It was remixing, adopting, and transforming. Welcome to the global echo chamber of Jamaican music. where reggae's children walk in rhythm and dance hall became diaspora. It started quietly. Immigrants from Jamaica landing in the UK, Canada, the US, and across the Caribbean carried more than suitcases. They carried sound systems, vinyl collections, and oral traditions. What began as backyard parties and underground radio shows soon morphed into full-blown musical revolutions. Let's begin in the United Kingdom. Here, in the tenement neighborhoods of London, Bristol, and Birmingham, second-generation Jamaicans fused their parents' roots with their lived realities: racism, class struggle, and dislocation. Reggae and dub didn't just survive, they evolved. The rise of two-tone ska, led by bands like The Specials and Madness, made Jamaican rhythm the voice of British youth rebellion. Out of those same streets came jungle, garage, and eventually grime, all genres pulsing with echoes of dub, the grit of dancehall, and the language of resistance. Artists like Dizzy Rascal, Wiley, and later Stormzy all acknowledged the foundation. Jamaica's bass culture raised them. Then there was Canada, especially Toronto, a city with one of the largest Jamaican diasporas in the world. Jamaican patios filtered into Canadian slang. Dancehall ruled clubs. Artists like Drake built entire aesthetics on the emotional DNA of reggae and dancehall, collaborating with artists like Popcon and Skillabang, weaving Jamaican slang and cadences into global pop. But perhaps the most dramatic transformation happened in Latin America. In the barrios of Panama, Jamaican immigrants working on the canal brought reggae rhythms that were reinterpreted in Spanish. The result? Reggaeton. Songs like El General's Tu Pun Pun were early blueprints. But it was in Puerto Rico that the genre exploded. Take a listen to Daddy Yankee's Gasolina, or Bad Bunny's entire catalog, and you'll hear it, the syncopated dancehall rhythm, the echo of Slang Ting, the DJ toasting style rebranded in Spanish. Reggaeton is dancehall's child, raised in a new tongue but carrying the same DNA of resistance, rhythm, and revelry. Across the Atlantic in West Africa, Jamaican music also found fertile soil. In Nigeria and Ghana, young artists absorbed dancehall swagger and merged it with highlife and Afrobeat traditions. The result? The meteoric rise of Afrobeats. Artists like Burna Boy, Wizkid, and Stone Boy credit reggae and dancehall as primary influences. Burna Boy once said, "Before I knew Fela, I knew Buju Banton." That's not just respect, that's lineage. Afrobeats became Afro dancehall. And the circle was complete. Jamaica, the descendant of Africa, now replanted its rhythm back in the motherland, reborn through new tongues, new beats, new voices. And then came the digital revolution. Suddenly, SoundCloud, YouTube, and TikTok shattered industry barriers. A youth from Portmore could upload a freestyle and go viral in Paris. A rhythm built in Kingston could dominate a dance challenge in Tokyo. Artists no longer needed labels. They needed Wi-Fi. This democratization of music put Jamaican sound everywhere. In car ads, movie soundtracks, gaming trailers, political protests. Dancehall and reggae weren't niche anymore, they were world culture. But with that global success came new questions. Who profits? Who controls the narrative? Is Jamaican culture being honored or mined? These aren't easy questions. As Afrobeat stars fill stadiums and latinx artists rake in billions, many Jamaican artists still struggle to break into those same markets. There's a disconnect between influence and inclusion, a risk that Jamaica becomes the invisible architect of a global sound empire. Still, Jamaican artists continue to push forward. Popcon collaborates with global icons, bringing dancehall to new heights. Coffee wins Grammys with a message of hope rooted in reggae's tradition. Shensia, Misika, and Skillabang bring a new fusion of trap, pop, and dancehall. And the sound systems still roll out at street corners, local, raw, unfiltered. Because despite everything, the exports, the remixes, the chart toppers, dancehall's power remains in its roots. It is the voice of a people too often ignored. It is a rhythm that travels like lightning but grounds like truth. It is a beat that crosses borders but never forgets where it came from. Reggae's children now speak in Spanish, Yoruba, Chui, French, Japanese, and drill. But they all skank to the same heartbeat. That's the global dancehall effect. From Kingston to the cosmos. From Trenchtown to TikTok, the future of Jamaican sound. It began in the dust of Trenchtown, with borrowed guitars, zinc-roof tenement yards, and voices raised above poverty. It grew through ska, rocksteady, reggae, dub, and dancehall, each evolution a rebellion, each rhythm a reflection of the times. And now, in the 21st century, the Jamaican sound has migrated again. This time, it lives not just on vinyl or cassette, not even just on stage, but in the palms of our hands, in scrolls, in viral loops, in 15-second hooks heard by billions. Welcome to the age of the algorithm, where the beat never sleeps, and Jamaican music continues to shape the global soundtrack. But make no mistake, this isn't a story of replacement. It's a story of reinvention. In an era of digital dominance, where TikTok and YouTube define stardom, the sound that once echoed from hand-built sound systems now booms from Bluetooth speakers and phone screens. Artists no longer wait for record deals. They drop tracks at midnight and spark global trends by morning. Take Coffee, for example. With Toast, she didn't just give thanks, she gave voice to a generation searching for optimism in chaos. Her clean vocals and crossover appeal have put reggae on Grammy stages and college dorm playlists in equal measure. Yet she still speaks the language of Trenchtown, the rhythm of faith, roots, and forward motion. Then there's Popcon, whose blend of dancehall authenticity and Afrobeats collaborations with Davido, Drake, and Burna Boy make him a cultural bridge, Jamaica to Africa, ghetto to global. Shenseea, a bashment queen for the digital age, turned her raw talent into international firepower. Her lyrical agility, genre blending, and hypervisual branding strategy mark her as a new kind of dancehall icon. One who understands that a hook must now hit in under 7 seconds. Even Skillabang, with his chopped flows and surreal lyricism, has turned the seemingly local into the digitally exotic, exporting the sound of modern Jamaica into hip-hop circles in London and New York with nothing but a mic, a rhythm, and his signature style. But what's truly fascinating is how the core DNA of Jamaican music survives this transformation. The rhythm is still sacred. The slang still evolves. The dance still dictates culture. The bassline still pulses like a prophecy. In the digital jungle, the sound remains sovereign. Yet the challenges are real. In an oversaturated digital world, visibility doesn't guarantee legacy. For many artists, viral fame comes fast, and vanishes even faster. What happens to depth in a world of loops? What happens to roots in a time of remixes? And deeper still, what does Jamaica own in this future? While global acts reap billions off reggae-influenced styles, the island's originators still struggle for recognition, streaming revenue, and stage time. The Jamaican government has been slow to recognize the economic potential of its cultural exports. Infrastructure lags. Institutions falter. Yet the people, the artists, the creatives, they never stop moving. That's why today there's a new generation not just performing, but building. They're launching independent labels, creating online archives, producing documentaries, opening cultural schools, and using platforms like Bandcamp and Audiomack to keep ownership where it belongs, with the creators. This is digital maroonage. This is sonic resistance in the cloud. Young producers are blending traditional Nyabingi drums with trap beats. Filmmakers are documenting Kingston's dance crews with cinematic precision. Scholars are reframing reggae as not just entertainment, but as world-shaping philosophy. And globally, the diaspora is responding. Reggae festivals thrive in Germany, Japan, Gambia, Colombia. TikTok trends remix dancehall tutorials, patois phrases, and sound system culture with millions of views. Even K-pop idols borrow the bass drop. Jamaica's spirit lives in choreography, samples, style, and swagger worldwide. Still, the question lingers. What's next? Will the next Bob Marley be born from a freestyling youth in Spanish Town with only a smartphone and Wi-Fi? Will Jamaica lead the global wave of decentralized music ecosystems, where ownership and storytelling are equally sacred? Will there be a return to roots, or a deeper plunge into genre-bending experimentation? If history tells us anything, it's this. Jamaican music never ends. It only transforms. Like water, like fire, like voice. So from the zinc rooftops of yesteryear to the fiber optics of today, the message remains. Sound is resistance. Rhythm is memory. Culture is forever. Jamaica may be small, but its sound is infinite. From Trenchtown to TikTok. From turntables to timelines. From street corners to streaming empires. The beat goes on. And the world still moves to Jamaica's rhythm.